Howdy, partners. Today's episode of the podcast is brought to you by Gamban. Gamban, blocking all that online gambling for you. Check out Gamban.com for pricing. And remember, it creates friction and it's a tool in your toolbox to prevent gambling harm. So use it wisely and use it now. Also, thank you to Epic Risk Management for sponsoring this episode of the podcast, partners. Really appreciate Epic's continued sponsorship of this show. And now enjoy this conversation with the Executive Director of the National Council on Problem Gambling, Mr. Keith White. Hello and welcome to All in the Addicted Gamblers podcast. My name is Brian and I have not placed a bet since July of 2014.
And my name is Jeff. I haven't placed a bet since July of 2015.
Jeff, it's good to see you.
It's nice to see you as well, Brian. You've been working hard, huh?
Yeah, I've been pumping out podcasts. But you've been working hard, so you haven't been able to join. But you're still listed as the co-host, my friend.
Well, you know what? Keith's here, so I had to join.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, speaking of one of your many jobs, Jeff, that you do in the gambling harm world, here is somebody that you work with, the executive director of the National Council on Problem Gambling, Keith White. Keith, thanks for doing this. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Brian and Jeff. And just to be clear, I work for Jeff as a member of the board of directors. He's one of my 15 bosses, and it's awesome.
Thank you for clearing that up. Now, I have to tell everybody that Keith has classic rock albums hanging on the wall behind him. So this will be an excellent conversation because he has good taste in music.
No, it is. And like you said, you can always have a good conversation with someone that appreciates the classics.
Exactly. Exactly. I agree.
I take that as a compliment. So,
Keith, let's start with your background. How long have you worked for the National Council and what were you doing prior to that?
Sure. I came to the National Council in October of 1998. Prior to that, I have always been a DC policy advocate. So I started my career at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services way back during the first Clinton administration and at the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation. And after that, I went to the American Bar Association in the section of individual rights, where we worked on issues related to access to healthcare, discrimination, what we now call diversity, equity, and inclusion. Back in the 90s, it was a little bit different. From there, I went to be the director of research at the American Gaming Association. So for 3 years, I was at the AGA from 95 to 98. And that's where I first started learning about gambling as an issue. And part of my job was to research and understand issues that were facing the industry. It became clear to me then, even in 1995, that problem gambling was an enormous issue for the industry. And it's one that they weren't taking seriously. You know, the field was still embryonic. You know, there was still debates then and, you know, now about what we call it, you know, how do you respond to it? What are the policy responses? And part of my job was to work with groups like the National Council, which have been around for a very long time, but they were a relatively small organization, mainly a collection of state affiliate chapters. And the more I worked with the National Council, the more I realized that there was a really interesting, the National Council played a really interesting role. And when NCPG at the time received funding to hire a full-time staffer, I threw my hat in the ring. And they were foolish enough to hire me, and I was foolish enough to take the job because it was I had no administrative experience, I had no fundraising experience, and so I became executive director, like I said, in October 1998, and never looked back. But it's been an incredible journey, and you know, I've certainly learned a lot, and having been chief cook and bottle washer, so you know, I at one point or another, I did everything. You know, for the National Council's operations, because back in 1998, I was the sole staff person. And, you know, I'm glad to have grown it today. But just a little bit of my background, you know, I just want to make sure folks know that, you know, I worked for the Gambling Industry Trade Association. And I think the choice that the National Council board made back then, you know, was deliberate, because working with the gambling industry is one of the big important roles for the National Council, not the sole role, And we can talk about neutrality and all that too, but having a relationship and being able to push and advocate to the industry is a critical function of what we do.
Well, let's start with people who might be experiencing gambling harm. Would you give out the 800 number for the National Council if anybody at this moment is experiencing harm and looking for help?
Yes. So we run a 24-hour nationwide helpline. It's 800-522-4700. And the way that this helpline works, it connects you to resources in your area, which are, of course, mainly the state affiliate chapters of the National Council. But the helpline, the national helpline, 800-522-4700, works a lot like 911, where if you're in crisis, if you have a gambling problem, you're in crisis, call the national number and you will get help. You'll get answered everywhere in the country. No other helpline, no other gambling helpline, to our knowledge, works that way. So this is, it's a service we provide for free for callers. You can text and chat as well. So you can text to 800-522-4700. And again, you'll get help no matter where you are in the country. And you can chat to ncbgambling.org/chat. And I can tell you, Brian and Jeff knows this from our reporting. Last year alone, voice calls to the national number went up 45%. Texts to the national number went up 85%. And chats went up 117%. We still think that the majority of people who have gambling problems never call, because we're still only at about 276,000 calls, texts, and chats last year, which is a fraction of the 6.5 million people we believe have gambling problems right now. So 250 is good, or 270 is good. There are other helplines that total doesn't include. Ours is, you know, by far the largest by volume, but it still represents, you know, arguably probably less than 10% of people who we estimate have serious gambling problems in right now. Less than 10% have called the helpline in the past year, and so what the other 90% are doing? Are they white knuckling it? You know, and obviously some of them are probably just going straight to rooms, or they're self-referring through the web, but there is still a massive gap between the number of people who need help and the number of people who are reaching help, as far as we can tell.
Hey Keith, you know, I was telling Brian before we started the podcast that this happens to be my day where I'm taking calls on our helpline here in Delaware. And as somebody that works the helpline, you know, 3-4 times a month, I would say that the great majority of the calls that I get are what we call nuisance calls.
Yes.
Where somebody is asking what the Powerball numbers are, or I'm having problems getting my loyalty points from the casino. Yep. And in speaking with other people that are familiar with helplines across the country, this is not a unique issue that we're dealing with here in Delaware. What's your take on that? Why does that happen?
Oh, I think it mainly happens because we don't have anywhere near the advertising you would need. So most of the promotion of the helpline is done by the gambling industry. And, you know, it is just and appropriate. It's important for them to make sure to publicize the helpline number. But if those are essentially the only people that publicize the helpline number, you're going to drive a lot of customer service calls through that. And especially if the industry doesn't do a good job of you know, distinguishing in their ads between, you know, this is a helpline number for people who have gambling problems, and this is our number for customer service or account rep or whatever it is, the buffet, you know, the winning number on the Powerball. And so, you know, our initial goal for the first, you know, 40 years of the National Council was to get the industry to publicize the number. You know, we've done that through regulation, through legislation, through advocacy, and by and large, that's starting to happen. Now our challenge for the next couple decades is going to be to promote the number properly. And, you know, so it's interesting to think that, because the National Council has no advertising budget, we rely entirely on earned media. That is going to change in this quarter, because we have funding to develop our own public service announcement. But a public service announcement is not going to run, you know, at 3 o'clock, you know, in prime time. You know, public service announcements are generally going to run, you know, after hours and stuff. So we still have a problem that we're not out there on the airwaves with an actual problem gambling message, because the industry promotion of the helpline is great, but it's almost entirely responsible gambling messages. And I think there's a big distinction between that. So Jeff, to get back to your question, a couple of ways. One, it's that the industry is doing what we ask, but it's it's an industry message. And so there's a lot of confusion around that. Clearly they could do a lot of job at making that, that call to action better, more specific, more actionable. You know, there may be a time and place where we ask, for example, state lotteries to either stop putting the number on the back of the ticket if that's the only number, or doing a better job. You know, I actually think that this massive bombardment of sports betting ads, I think there's a lot of issues with that. But if they have to post 20 different helpline numbers on there for 1 second and 1 point font, there's a discussion to be had of whether or not that's actually counterproductive, whether or not we should say, look, if you're going to do it so poorly and you're going to be forced to do it so many ways by regulators, maybe you pull it off the ad, and then you just every fourth ad you run a full 30-second spot on responsible gambling or problem gambling. Like it's at that point, because roughly I would say between the 27 state and regional helplines on our network, roughly 90% of calls to the helpline are not what we would call intake calls. You know, they're not someone who you're going to have a conversation with about, you know, maybe their gambling harm. So it's a massive amount, and it's costly, it's time consuming. You know, we want the number to be advertised broadly or promoted broadly, but I think now there's a discussion to be had as everybody takes responsible gambling a little more seriously, about moving away from that broadcast shotgun promotion and thinking a little bit more about tailored targeting messages to try and increase the ratio of intake calls to problematic calls, to try and work with industry and other stakeholders better to drive awareness of what the purpose of the helpline is. And, you know, I know there's a lot of people who call who are not crisis callers, and I know there's a lot of people in crisis who don't call. And so, you know, we've got to balance both sides of that equation. And I think once the long-term goal is, you know, once we're able to get advertising funding, you know, and significant advertising funding, once we can counter program against the billions of dollars that is being spent to market sports betting, that's when you're really going to see that ratio change. You know, because when you control your message, obviously you're going to send an appropriate message that would almost 100% of callers that saw a national council ad, I would assume, would be people who actually have a gambling problem. But right now we don't have an ad. We don't even have a PSA. So we're relying on others. We're relying on third parties to send that message. And
when you see a third party sending that message and they're talking about problem gambling, sometimes I think it's interpreted like, yes, I'm having a problem gambling because I'm not getting my loyalty points, or
I'm locked out of my account. Yeah,
or I'm locked out of my, exactly. So it's the ambiguity of the term as well, which causes confusion, and which is a shame. And you're right. I mean, especially if that number is promoted by the industry, that already creates that assumption that, okay, they're giving us a number in case we have a problem with the way we're gambling.
Yeah.
In terms of not harm from gambling, but in terms of our gambling activity, that we're not, you know, getting the right points, or as you said, you know, we're locked out of our account.
Well, if you think about it, it's a little discordant, and it's a little bit different than what we do with alcohol and tobacco advertising. So for the longest time, you had a you know, sort of cancer kills message, or you had nothing on tobacco, and then you had a cancer kills message. But by and large, you know, tobacco ads are not required to advertise the quit line. You know, by and large, most alcohol ads have, you know, drink responsibly or blah, 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 but they don't have a specific call to action. So in some sense, you know, gambling is again a little bit ahead of some of these other addictions. But it causes, you know, there's no free lunch, right? So there's always consequences to that. And I think, you know, where we started with requiring ads to, for example, feature a state helpline number, and it was a landline area without national advertising, sports betting, without the World Wide Web, without digital. Now that we're where we are in 2022, some of those old regulations, again, may be a little bit counterproductive. So it's a good rethink we need to have. It's not just always promote the helpline number, full stop. Now I think it's a lot more nuanced. How do we promote the helpline number better? What guidance can we give to all stakeholders, including the industry, to make sure that it's being messaged appropriately as a crisis line for people who have serious problems?
Keith, when I met you in person, I talked about that I have a Michigan phone number. I live in Connecticut. So if I call the National Council's phone number, it'll route me back to Michigan.
Yep.
When you want to have one phone number, that seems like a pitfall of that feature. So how do we solve that problem, and what would go into solving that?
Yeah, well, we set our helpline network up in 1995 when it was only landlines. And so, and most helplines also have that same challenge. So we are working right now to get geolocation capability so that we would, if you're calling on a cell phone, instead of the originating area code, which as you say, is often, you know, in a different location than when you are, we could route by the caller's actual location, even on a state level, or even by the nearest cell phone tower. That is an incredibly difficult process to do. 911 is required by law, but believe it or not, when you call 911, the telephone company has no choice but to give them your geolocation. That is the only number in the entire United States where that happens. So no other crisis line does geolocation right now because there's enormous privacy concerns, because you essentially slam someone's phone and unlock their GPS regardless of what permissions they've put on. So for the National Problem Gambling Helpline, the geolocation that we want, the tier two geolocation, which is not your physical location, but your state-based location, is proving to be a much more difficult process. We are actively doing that. Because it's the involuntary location that's the problem. When you do a lot of calls to other helplines, if you give them permission to locate your phone, that's a different thing. But as a crisis line, we don't want to have to go through opt-in to get your, you know, da da da. I mean, that's critical seconds that we would waste. And there's a lot of people that just hang up if they get a menu like that. So we're trying to get the sort of location that you would mean that when you call up, Brian, it would just automatically basically slam your phone and, you know, force that location and force the carrier, your cellular carrier, one of hundreds of cellular carriers, to then send it to the right place. So we're working with that process. It may be legislative, it may be regulatory. We may have to go to FCC, we may have to go to Congress to get that authorization. But we believe as a crisis line, and given the high rate of lethality and suicidal ideation amongst people with severe gambling problems, it is just and appropriate. But it's proven a lot more challenging than we'd like. So right now we do have all the call centers in the helpline network have a warm transfer protocol. So if you have the Connecticut phone, but you call from Michigan, the state helpline that you hit has a direct warm transfer, and best practice is for them to warm transfer you directly to the helpline where you need to be. And to say, hey, Jeff, I've got a caller here, Brian, he needs help and you're in Delaware, and not hang up until that connection's been made. You know, not just give you a number and say, oh, you should hang up and dial 302, blah, blah, blah. Not the majority of calls to the helpline are still landline based. So we're still, you know, it is still a crisis service, but yeah, cell phones are one of the problems. There's a lot of other problems with handling 275,000 calls, texts, and chats a year. There's a lot of infrastructure that goes into that.
Does the National Council have a new role since this new wave of gambling since 2018, or is it the same role as it always has been?
That's a great question, Ryan. And I've been thinking about that question a lot. And I think it is both. This is a terrible answer. It's both similar and different. And I'd love to hear what Jeff thinks about this too, as a member of our board of directors. But from my perspective, most of the gambling that's going on online is in fact the same types of gambling we've done before, you know. And so there's a lot of, you know, and there's a lot of similarity between the problems people develop. However, that being said, there's a couple things that are fundamentally and categorically different that have changed our role. You know, one of them, of course, is the role of technology. And, you know, people are now gambling in ways that are actually different. You know, most Americans have never had access to online sports betting through their cell phone. The industry has been allowed to advertise nationally for quite a while, but the emergence of the league partnerships is a second major fundamental change, because you've never had in the United States broadcast advertising sports betting during events with the permission and even active involvement of the leagues. So that's, you know, advertising has always been around, but the role of the leagues, I think, and I think the role of the leagues, I think there's enormous opportunities to utilize their reach and brand. So technology, you know, the role of the leagues is different. But what I keep coming back to, which is both the same old thing, but new as well, is the role of state government. So one of the biggest reasons why so many states expanded sports betting after 2018 is that it was no longer taboo, and that the wave of state lotteries in the 70s and 80s, the wave of riverboat casinos in the 90s, all of it sponsored, you know, run by government in the state lottery case, or, you know, taxed and regulated and authorized in the case of riverboat casinos, continue, you know, over and over again, told the American public at the state level, legalized gambling is fine and good. And you know, National Council is neutral. So, you know, we're not saying legalized gambling is bad, but when your state government tells you it's not just a good thing, but actually you should really play the lottery more, you know, that playing the lottery is virtuous because it's going to help, you know, reduce taxes on senior citizens, or it's going to build roads, or it's going to fund teachers. That permission, that acceptability, allows a state a couple of years down the road to say, well, okay, why not do sports betting? You know, so the role of state government has always been one of approving or sort of condoning gambling. Now the role of state government, the thing that's changed since 2018, to your question, is that state government is now an active advocate. You know, I think when I got into the gambling field, the industry spent a lot of time and money trying to get casinos or new forms of gambling legalized in new states. Post 2018, casino development's the easiest job in the world. You sit back and wait for the state to call you and tell you what tax rate they're going to give you. Can we attract your industry into our state? It is so the zeal and the speed and the mercenary attitude that the states have taken towards sports betting in the past 3 years is that's been a fundamental change. You know, we talk a lot in the field about gambling going from sin to vice to disease. And I think for state government, it followed that same arc. And now it's virtue. Now it's a windfall. It's a way to raise taxes without raising taxes. You know, this is because the state keeps a monopoly on. And so I think the state role in addiction in general has always been to reduce, to protect, you know, minimize harm. You know, and they always, there was always that balancing act. Well, if we legalized alcohol, will we have more drunk driving? And we should do something about that. The state role in gambling is fundamentally different. And it's that has accelerated and changed even more rapidly since 2018. You know, and I think the early signs of it were when you saw governors placing the first ceremonial bets at their sports books. Never would have seen that years and years ago. You know, maybe they'd be there to open the casino, and they surely weren't there when the lottery started. They were nowhere near. And so this is a long way of answering your question. I promised I wasn't going to go long form, but there's so much into this.
No, you're good.
That's one of those things that is subtle. It's evolved. And then all of a sudden now we look at it in 2022 and we see it's completely flipped. The role of state government and their desperation for this revenue, their desperation to compete with other states, that is frankly a race to the bottom. We saw during the Great Recession and during the pandemic, a majority of states across the country lowered regulations, moved to cashless gaming, or expanded forms of gaming to deliberately try and make up for lost revenues during the recession, during the pandemic. You didn't see that with alcohol and tobacco. Maybe with alcohol a little bit. They allowed at-home delivery, and you could, you know, restaurants could kind of do off license. But you certainly didn't see most states, you know, go legalize opioids because they could take a huge tax thing, you know, deliberately to make up. So I think that's probably that's a bigger change even than the technology, the leagues or advertising or some of these other things.
So Keith, that issue which you succinctly described, and I entirely,
not so succinctly, but yeah.
Well, I entirely agree. I entirely agree with your points because there are many points that express that concern, but it sort of begs the question about the role of the federal government.
Yes.
So the federal government could enact regulations, legislation,
yes,
that would cover the things that you mentioned on a national basis. And of course, they could fund education, prevention, and treatment. Why doesn't that happen? Why hasn't that happened?
That has been our holy grail. That has been my biggest failure, one of many, but that is the cross I bear. Because I've been trying to spearhead federal legislation for more than 20 years of my life and have got nowhere. And that's not true. We actually have made a lot of headway at the national level. We've been able to get a lot of report language. But we are still no closer than we were in 1972 when we were started. This is our 50th anniversary. We're no closer to in 2022 than we were in 1972 to getting to having an actual federal appropriation. We're still no closer than we were then to getting language in the Public Health Service Act that officially, formally includes gambling addiction as in the federal government's health system. You know, so I don't say we're no closer. Technically, we're no closer. I think we've made a lot of progress. I think we're close. But that has been that the lack of affirmative federal legislation that both authorizes the federal government to address problem gambling and appropriates money. So it's authorization and appropriation. That has been the biggest challenge. And it makes me insane that it has been so hard, but it has been so hard. But yeah, so in what we would want to see, that the bills that we filed, the bills that we continue to push, are just that. The simplest is to get that authorization, get that appropriation. Because even if you add gambling addiction into the Public Health Service Act, the agencies are still going to do little or nothing unless you fund them. You know, so even if Congress tells them to do something, it's an unfunded mandate until you put the money behind it. But the great part about this is that the federal government has enormous revenue from legalized gambling. So one of the big myths out there is that because gambling is regulated and taxed on the state level, that it is left under the 10th Amendment to the states. That's where that's who should be addressing this. The federal government has no role. So the first part of that argument is correct. States that tax and regulate gambling absolutely categorically have to put some of that money back into prevent treat. And even states that don't. So Utah and Hawaii still have a public health issue. They still have to spend public money just like they do with drugs or cancer or any other disease or disorder that they haven't legalized. Nobody's legalized cancer. Everybody realizes it's a public health issue. You've got to deal with it. But it doesn't stop at the state level, because anyone who gambles knows that if you win a jackpot above the withholding amount, you pay a 24% federal tax. You know, and clever gamblers can get some of that money back. You can deduct your losses, blah, blah, blah. But set that aside. There is more than $7.5 billion with a B, dollars a year coming from the tax, withholding tax on gambling winnings to the Treasury. Plus, now there is also the excise tax on sports betting. It's 0.25%, but this is tax on handle, not revenue. So every sports bet that is placed, you basically pay a quarter on every, you know, a quarter of every $100 to the federal government. And that tax alone generated $50 million a couple of years ago with the massive expansion of sports betting. You know, if we spend as a country $1 billion on sports bets during the Super Bowl, someone who is better at math than me can figure out what 0.25% of $1 billion is. But one day of betting alone would be more money than the federal government has ever spent on problem gambling. And so our continued message to everybody is that it's not just a state issue. The federal government has a role, both generally, because this is a broad national public health disorder. 6.5 million people is something that the feds should be concerned about, but also taxation wise. So if you're making money off gambling, you have to put some of that money back to address the consequences. And we would like to see that money, you know, we take the whole $8 billion or $7.5 billion, but, you know, we'll take a chunk of it to start. You know, we want to see that money come back to grants at the state level, just the way the federal government funds alcohol and drug services. We want to see NIH and CDC and Bureau of Indian Affairs and Department of Justice, help us with gambling courts. So that money could and should be directed to help mitigate some of the harm from gambling problems. That's the holy grail. You know, that's what we'll never stop until we get that. It's been harder. It's been a huge, you know, it's been a huge challenge. It's been a huge obstacle for me and the entire National Council.
So Keith, I mean, obviously you've got the passion. You can tell that it really bothers you, right? And you have the facts. What, as you see it, what's the barrier? Is it just the inertia of the way government is? Is it just people don't still consider gambling a priority in terms of the harm that results? What do you see has been the biggest barrier?
I think it's C, all of the above. And so one big part of it is, as I said, many people around the country and certainly on the Hill feel like this is just a state problem. You know, Indiana's taxing and regulating casinos, so Indiana should put the money back. And if Indiana does, then Indiana people are okay. And if every state did that, we'd be fine. We know, of course, that's not the case, both because Indiana's not doing as much as they should, and other states are doing little or nothing. But also, this is the only disease or disorder that doesn't get federal support. So, you know, and there's that federal tax revenue. So one is just that the sort of ignorance about state regulation versus federal responsibility. Two, I think you hit it right on the head, is shame and stigma. You know, people with gambling problems are not sympathetic in general. We still know that the American public views people with gambling problems much differently than they view people with other substance abuse disorder. Some of that, again, is that naming and that framing. You know, the American public has generally understood over the past 20 years that substance abuse, you're not a bad person necessarily. It is the chemicals in the drugs that have helped cause changes in your brain. We know that people with gambling problems have those same physical changes. We know there's deep biological and genetic roots in this. We know it's not just bad behavior, but the general public doesn't. But that is why podcasts like this are so important. You know, so shame and stigma and the lack of sympathy, if you will, for problem gamblers is a big part of that. And I do believe the numbers are going in our direction. I believe that the overall goal of the National Council is and should always be to destigmatize gambling addiction, to promote positive stories about recovery, about prevention and treatment, you know, to change this whole issue in Americans' minds. We know that large social movements can flip an entire country. You know, we've seen any number of massive societal changes in how people view tobacco, how people view HIV/AIDS, how people view gay marriage. There's all sorts of things where there have been massive shifts in public opinion, but it has to be driven, you know, and it has to be driven towards a goal. And I think there too, the lack of resources, you know, we can talk all we want, but if we don't have a $10 million advertising campaign, you know, if we're not on the air, counter-programming, on TV, on your radio, you know, but this in podcasts like this, it's a great start, but that can't be the only way we're changing public. So that's part of it too. And then Jeff, I think a third point is, as you said, legislative inertia. We are now and have been for a long time in an era of bitterly partisan governance. Congress is not doing a whole lot of anything. And as they see it, adding a new program in to an already, you know, difficult, fractious conversation has been extremely difficult. None of these three things are excuses. You know, they're explanations. They are all addressable, but it has been so much harder than it should have been. And so, but I think if you had to point to the biggest factor of those three, and there are other smaller factors, it's public opinion. You know, Congress by and large is a creature reflects their constituents, and right now, most people in the United States do not view people with gambling problems as people who have a disorder. They view them as immoral, weak, greedy, you know, sinners, people who sort of lost control and should just stop gambling. They do not understand gambling addiction as a disorder. They see it as a moral weakness, or, you know, you're bad at math. And I'm sure you guys have all heard those tropes. That is changing, of course. We're actively trying to destigmatize and change it, but that the more public awareness and the positive public awareness we create, the easier it will be to have that discussion on the Hill, ultimately. And it's also going to take, you know, an enormous grassroots effort, and the National Council has not been very good at that. You know, we have 35 state chapters. Being able to mobilize an army of grassroots activists at the district level, you know, and I never want to blame, and I hope nobody hears me as blaming people at grassroots level for not speaking up. But when you have an opportunity to talk to your congressional candidate at a county fair, or talk to them when they're a supervisor at a town council meeting, you know, to raise the importance of addressing gambling problems at that local level, that seeps up into Congress. And the lack of that message, the lack of that narrative, leaves them to their own devices. And so there's so much more we can do as we look towards March, towards Problem Gambling Awareness Month. A lot of the thrust behind Problem Gambling Awareness Month is to help have that conversation at the local level. Put up a flyer in your local coffee shop, you know, tweet about the All In podcast on your social media. Maybe a friend will pick it up, or maybe, you know, there's so much we can do. And it's little tiny, tiny, tiny bits. You never know when you're going to hit somebody with that moment of clarity, or when something's going to stick in someone's mind, and they're going to then, you know, take the next step or the next step.
I did have that great pleasure of being able to go to my congressman, and I stood up in a room of people and I confessed to having a gambling addiction, and I just did not get a great response from him. He was looking for water at the time when I gave my spiel, and but I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I said it in a room full of people, because they all heard it as well. So at least they heard it. That was pretty great. Did you have another follow-up question?
It's enormously hard, and we credit anybody who is willing and able to stand up and speak out, but we know most people in recovery don't, and so we never want to compromise anyone's recovery. We never want to place the weight, you shouldn't be responsible for changing other people's opinions. You know, that's probably the main reason that Monsignor Dunn and Dr. Custer and the members of Gamblers Anonymous in New York helped found the National Council, is to be that public voice. You know, we should be carrying that weight as well. So I hope nobody that listens ever feels obligated or guilty about if they choose not to speak out. That's a role for some, but it's not a role for everybody. And it's got to be something, you know, your recovery comes first. You know, if and when you are willing to share that, that's one thing. But you know, I hope it never comes off as, you know, people with gambling problems who've dealt with so much, you know, have to take on this additional burden too of educating all these other, frankly, ignorant people. You know,
we've been trained in our 12 step rooms to be quiet about it and keep it in the room. And that's where I think part of the pitfall of speaking out is. And that's what we try to do with the podcast. But
yeah, well, advocacy with anonymity is really difficult. There's a lot of lessons from other addictions. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has some steps, but again, that's a lot of our job, and you know, we need that support. But you know, that, you know, we feel like there's an important role for the National Council to play. That was what we were created to do, is to be that national advocate, to keep being out there, to keep speaking, to keep, you know, helping send that message. And, but, you know, but there is a faces and voices part of this. And those, you know, like you guys who are able to do that, it's such a positive story, because it does humanize the issue.
Keith, can you foresee, especially with all the new online operators, can you foresee the industry playing any role in terms of advocacy for federal funding and federal regulation?
I think they should. I would argue that it is in their long-term interest, but I also think that there are many people in the industry who either think short-term or who are cynical about it, who don't want the federal government involved, because the argument is, as I understand it, that federal health money leads to federal regulation, which leads to federal taxation. You know, and you know, one of the reasons that that the industry is scared of federal taxation is that it's been floated any number of times. Like I said, sin taxes are popular at the state level. That's why the governments are so thrilled with sports betting right now, state government, but they're also popular at the federal level. And in fact, one of the things that motivated the formation of the American Gaming Association back in 1994, 1995, was the Clinton administration had floated a federal tax on gambling revenue to help fund the first shot of healthcare. So there's a lot of precedent there. You know, there's already this federal excise tax on sports betting. The federal excise tax on sports betting handle used to be 10%. So the federal government took 10% of every sports bet, which made most sports books completely unprofitable. And it was one of the ways the federal government cracked down and was trying to drive out the sports betting industry in the 60s. They simply put this huge tax on the handle, and most books went out of business, because you can't, you know, you you can't really run sports betting on with a 10% tax. It has been reduced over the year, over the years, and thus, of course, sports betting is now flourishing. But you know, there is the industry, of course, would probably be crippled if the excise tax on sports betting was raised. So we know some of their concerns at the national level, but the positive case is, if you want to build a long-term sustainable industry, if you want to avoid the backlash like we're seeing in the UK, if you want to, you know, make sure that gambling is a product that is not aggressively regulated at the federal level, as it has been in the past, then you would be smart. This is insurance, you know, because we're, you know, if you don't have the research dollars we need, you know, then there's going to be that constant drumbeat, you know. So either get the federal government out of the gambling business entirely, and even if you did, I think they would still have a responsibility. So I don't think that, I think that line of argument is self-defeating, because federal government doesn't get any money from cancer, you know, but that we still spend hundreds of millions of dollars to prevent, treat, and research it. This is a disease, it's a disorder. You know, it doesn't matter whether or not it's legal, whether or not it's being taxed, you have to address it. So I think it's the billion-dollar question, Jeff. We don't have enough support from the industry. We should. I think there's a lot of folks that are thinking short term. I think there's a lot of folks that are scared of a theory, but people are hurting now. We don't have the funding we need to do comprehensive programs. So I'm not worried about playing this five-dimensional chess and what might happen. You know, research leads to regulation, which leads to taxation, possibly, maybe some 10 years down the road. We need help now. You know, the safety net is the national safety net, if you can even call it that, is tattered. There are gaping holes, and, you know, no state has a comprehensive set of prevention, treatment, education, research, responsible gaming, and recovery services. And until that happens, and even if it did happen, we would still call on the federal government to be involved. So I don't know that I don't think that dodging this question or kicking the can down the road in terms of federal support for health does the industry any long-term good. And it certainly harms people with gambling problems in the short term. And it harms state government. You know, state governments are used to getting federal support for all these other health issues. You know, we've left Delaware and New York and Michigan on their own entirely. The federal government, the feds have left every state on their own. And the states rely on federal best practices and support and research, you know, through NIH and stuff for everything except gambling. It's just this like wormhole of public policy and concern. And it's created a lot more harm than it should.
Keith is going to come back again on another podcast, because we have plenty more stuff to get to. But before we end this one, I want to ask about the role of lived experience within the National Council, because to the naked eye, and in a lot of lived experience, this is where I think a lot of fractions in the UK happen, is that we look at an organization like the National Council and we see them with the industry and the close ties with the industry. And then we're frustrated because we're like, well, what about us? I understand that you have to take funding from the industry because that's the only place where money is coming from right now. But as far as the relationship with the industry versus the relationship with lived experience?
I think it's a great question. And, you know, it's always appropriate. And we invite that criticism. So I think it's true that since 1972, there have always been people in recovery on our board of directors. So for 50 years, if you look at our leadership, we have always had lived experience at the core. There's been industry folks on the board for about 10 years. So the vast majority of our history was lived experience. I think that would always be the case. That's always been the case as long as I've been here. So that's one, at the leadership level, at the fundamental, you know, operational, legal heart of what we do, recovery has always been represented in the top echelons of our leadership. It is also, when you look at the three membership classes of the National Council, when you look at individual members, a big share or percentage of individual members are people in recovery or with lived experience. There's also a lot of counselors, there's researchers, there's others, but there's a lot of reasons why individual members would join the National Council. One of the biggest ones is that they're in recovery from a gambling problem. When you look at the state affiliate chapters, these 35 state affiliate chapters, almost all of them were started by someone in recovery. Almost all of them have that same principle that we do, that you always need to have people in recovery in leadership. And then, you know, you look at the organizational members. One of the common myths is that it's only the gambling industry that are the corporate members of the National Council. We have treatment agencies, and almost every treatment agency, any treatment agency worth its salt, I would say, is deeply involved in the recovery community. And many of them are founded by, run by, administered by people in recovery. And then there's a lot of other new breed of companies that are coming into the field. So there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there, many with lived experience, some even coming from the UK, as you would say, who are marketing apps and teletherapy and lots of other services for problem gamblers in a field that's been defined by poverty. As it grows, there are a lot more opportunities for people to get involved and for people to make a buck and that in problem gambling. And that sounds, you know, it sounds commercial in a way, but that is one of the great drivers of progress, at least in the United States, in all the other addictions. You know, you have to be able to fund these programs and services. You know, not everybody can make a living as a charity. You know, we're lucky as a nonprofit that we've been able to sustain our funding and quite frankly, thrive in some cases. But that's not the experience for most people. Most people, you know, especially if you're in recovery, and you know, you've got to find a way to make a living. And to be able now to make a living within the gambling field is increasingly possible for people who then bring that lived experience back in. And then there's more apps and there's more services and there's more, you know, people we're hiring as peer counselors and preventionists, and they have lived experience. And then they, you know, so I do think in the US context, I mean, let's be honest, this is a capitalist society. You know, you have to think about that economic imperative. And so as the field grows and as we push the field to grow, there's more and more opportunities for people that in the past who were in recovery, there was no pathway for them to contribute productively. You know, and they maybe did it as a hobby. They did it as a volunteer job. Now you can do it full time. You can be professional in this field in a lot of different areas. And so I think that is going to long-term benefit the National Council. And then the other thing I would say with lived experience is, and it harkens back to the comments I said before about social change, destigmatization. The more we're able to get individual members of the grassroots level, that counterbalances the influence of other sectors, such as the gaming industry, and it leads to that recognition. You know, when we go to Capitol Hill and we say, and someone says, "How many members do you have nationwide?" and I say 1,000, that conversation stops generally right there. That is not very impressive. For 6.5 million people with gambling problems, for tens of millions of family members and loved ones, you know, there's what, 1 million industry employees? To have only 1,000 of all our entire membership, that includes individual and affiliates. This is masked a little bit because, for example, in Delaware, many people in Delaware probably join Jeff's organization. They don't necessarily join the National Council. But at some point, numbers are power. Numbers are recognition. And if we want to, especially if people with lived experience are concerned about the perceived influence of the industry, as they should be and as we should be, then become a part, add your voice, you know, help balance it out, you know, get into leadership, join a committee. And again, I don't want to hear this as blame. You know, the people in recovery, you know, don't have to do any of these things. But if you're critical of the National Council from the outside, come and join. You know, we're open to everybody. You know, we're a coalition of the willing, and we do great stuff. I think it would be incredibly rewarding. You know, most people who become members stay members, but most people who are involved in the gambling field, the vast majority of people involved in the gambling field, the vast majority of people in recovery aren't members. And again, it's not their obligation, but it's an opportunity. And so if we want to continue to change that conversation, that's one big way to do it. I would much rather have 25,000 individual members than one $25,000 contribution from a company, whether it's gambling or whether it's NFL or whether it's IBM or Coca-Cola. Because I think that's the big thing too. The NFL grant is transformational. The money is the multi-year, multi-million dollar commitment. It's great. it's transformational. It is the first major non-gambling organization. The NFL's brand and intellectual property is much more valuable than any amount of money they will ever give us, because that helps us get to Nike and Adidas and Coca-Cola and all these other companies. So that's the, it's an important concern. You know, we try and be transparent as possible. We invite people to join us. There's an enormous opportunity for folks with lived experience to get involved and to help shape the National Council. We do listen to our members.
Speaking of the NFL grant, where is that money going? And I also understand, I believe you have a webinar coming up to explain the agility grants that are happening with that.
We do. And it's really exciting. So
we'll get you out of here on that question.
That's great. The NFL money is being split into three major buckets. The first bucket is helpline modernization. So we're going to spend a lot of money trying to make sure that, you know, like you said, if you've got a Connecticut cell phone and you call from Michigan, you're going to get to the right place. We're going to improve training, standards, certification, reporting. So that there's a lot that goes into that. It's very technical, but it's necessary. The second major bucket are communications initiatives. And so the NFL has funded us to develop our first TV public service announcement. We have developed responsibleplay.org, which everybody has seen because that's what the NFL is promoting through their ad. And there's some other communications initiatives around there. And then last but not least, as you mentioned, the agility grants. So we're taking roughly a third of that NFL grant and we're putting it back out into the field for youth prevention. It's the as far as I know, it's the first national youth prevention grants. And so these are what we term the agility grants. We have released the first round. We've released the RFP for the first round. Recently, it closes later this month. And then we hope to make the awards in for this first round in March. And you'll then see people at the state and local level start to have for the first time national funding to develop youth prevention programs. And then we will do grants throughout the 3-year life cycle of the NFL grant. It's our hope that maybe by the end of this, we'll have funded anywhere from 20 to 50 youth gambling prevention organizations that will then bring back, you know, because when you look at the two buckets for the NFL grant, one is innovation and one is amplification. We're going to focus on taking a substance abuse prevention program for a specific population, a specific area, and doing it, adding gambling, seeing if we can use that model. You know, taking an existing gambling program that's maybe focused on at-risk youth in a particular area and seeing if it's going to work for at-risk youth in a different area or from a different culture. You know, technology. We want to bring together the amplification pillar of our grant strategy is to bring together young voices and voices of people with lived experience. Because, you know, innovation is a lot technical and it's evaluation and it's research and it's proving that there's been change, you know, that this message worked in this population. But amplification is hearing from people themselves, both young people and people who've been affected, about what prevention messages they think work. You know, and bringing these youth leaders together, destigmatizing, learning lessons from these other addictions. For the first time ever, helping people have a conversation around gambling. And in a way that they've had these conversations around drugs and alcohol and sex and rock and roll for decades, but we've never really included gambling in a formal way. And again, Delaware has done this. Many of our state chapters have done bits and pieces. And we hope that many of the applicants for these agility grants will be our state chapters to help them expand and evaluate the good work they're doing. And maybe these are now national templates. Because the ultimate goal for the agility grants is to move the needle in terms of awareness, but to make it easier for someone who wants to do youth prevention in their community to have a template, to have a model, to not have to reinvent the wheel, to be able to say, oh, look, here's this website with all these different programs that worked for youth or that work for this specific population, or that when you're talking to student athletes, here's a set of guidelines. You know, because so much of what we do now at the state level and the local level is not based on theory and it's not based on evidence. It's not being done generally, but when it's being done, we've had to rebuild it. We've had to build it ourselves. You know, there's not models. There's not good templates. We waste so much time and energy building this stuff instead of working from best practices, working down from best practices. Again, part of that is because the feds aren't involved. SAMHSA and NIH are they're a big part of their role is to collect the national research and to help people. Then here's the toolkit, here's the guidelines, here's the study, here's what, and then just, you know, implement it. We can't just implement stuff because we have to create it. We have to add the gambling, you know, in the words of Lisa Pertzoff, who was one of the founders of Jeff's organization, the Delaware Council. She said the majority of her job consisted with in going to substance abuse and other meetings and just waiting until they stopped talking about whatever issue they were talking about and just saying, and gambling, you know, but it's true. And so the agility grants, we're not going to solve all youth prevention issues. I want to be very clear, but it's a start. It's a start. It's creating that conversation, raising that awareness, and then creating models that then people in hundreds and thousands of communities can use to help prevent youth from developing a problem. You know, and that's what most kids in the United States never get a focused prevention message around gambling, and that's unethical. You know, that's unbearable. I mean, we can't continue to ignore this. But we'll start that conversation, and then a lot of other folks are gonna carry it forward.
When you talk about youth, Keith, just for clarification, what ages are you focusing on in terms of prevention programs?
So this is a great question. And we are going to, what we've told folks is you can define youth however you want. So if you can make an argument that, you know, me at, let's just say a little bit over 50, I'm youthful enough. And, you know, if that's an argument that's going to carry with the review committee, that's great. But we assume that most of it's going to skew in that 18 to 24 age range, you know, where we know there's a big, problems really, really concentrated. But, you know, especially as our first round of grants, we set the gate open. The only formal requirement is that you have to be a nonprofit. And we're saying, hey, look, make a pitch. You know, if you can make a pitch that 25 to 35 year olds is the key group, and you've got a great program, and you know you can show that you're going to evaluate it, you know, we'll take a look at it. So yeah, it's a great question. We would love to see programs that pitched us the 12 to 17, you know, because I think that's where the age of initiation starts. I mean, we would look at middle school programs. You know, it's harder to do, but doesn't mean, you know, it's a critical group.
Well, Keith White, Executive Director of the National Council on Problem Gambling, thank you so much for your time today. And I look forward to doing this again. That was, I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Jeff. You're doing great work, and I'm really, really pleased to be here, and happy to come back anytime. It's really, for me, extremely important, and I'm really grateful.
Well, thank you.
We'll do it again. And thanks, absolutely, to Jeff, and thanks everybody for listening.
This podcast is owned by Lee Street Media, LLC. Music provided by T. Vance. Remember, this is a podcast. The views expressed on the podcast are solely those of the hosts and the guests. If you need help for a gambling addiction, please seek professional help.